This is 1A. I'm Jen White in Washington. With coronavirus surging worldwide, scientists are racing to develop a safe and effective vaccine. Three companies, Pfizer, Moderna, and AstraZeneca, have candidates that look promising. But these vaccines aren't your normal flu shot. They use mRNA, one of the latest advances on the cutting edge of biotechnology. But what is it exactly? Joining us to help answer that question is Angela Rasmussen. She's a virologist at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. Angela, it's great to have you back with us.
It's great to be back, Jen. Thanks for having me.
Also here, Walter Isaacson. He's been one of the participants in the Pfizer vaccine trials. He's also a professor of history at Tulane University and author of the upcoming book, The Codebreaker. It explores gene editing and the biotech revolution. Walter, we're glad to have you.
Thanks for having me back.
So, Angela, without, if possible, getting too technical, what is RNA and what is mRNA?
Okay, so RNA is similar to DNA in that it is a molecule that encodes genetic information. mRNA refers to messenger RNA, and that specifically is a molecule of RNA that is used to give a cell instructions on how to make a protein. So that's really what it encodes. It's essentially a blueprint for a protein, and our cells normally make mRNAs. That's how we actually express the genes that are encoded in our DNA. For these vaccines, what that mRNA is encoding is the spike protein from SARS coronavirus 2, which our body will then make immune responses against.
So I've heard this term spike protein quite a lot. Explain a little bit more about what that actually is.
So the spike protein is so named because it looks like a spike jutting out from the surface of the virus particle. And what the spike protein actually does is it binds the receptor on the host cell, on our cells, and that's a molecule called ACE2. When the spike protein binds ACE2, that gives the cell instructions essentially to take the virus inside of it to begin the infection.
Now, Walter, I want to talk about your experience being a part of the Pfizer trial. How did you decide to become a participant?
Well, I'm writing about messenger RNA and about RNA in general. It's the most amazing molecule. In fact, it's probably the molecule that started life on this planet. We're using it now to edit genes. That's what CRISPR is and part of the biotech revolution. So totally fascinated about RNA. I'm down in New Orleans and, you know, I hear about this trial going on. Both Pfizer and Moderna, two pharmaceutical companies, are doing trials using messenger RNA, as was said, to build the spike, have our own cells build the spike protein to cause immunity to COVID. And so I just went online at the end of July and signed up. I got a call the next day, went to Ochsner Hospital, and you know they make sure you don't know whether you got the placebo or the real thing, but I got shots.
And at this point, do you still not know whether you took the vaccine or the placebo?
Correct. I think, you know, some people can get themselves tested, you know, whether you're swollen or not. Because I'm writing about it, I'm playing by the rules, I'm being very safe, and I'm not trying to figure out which one I got.
Well, Melissa on Facebook says, I'm in this Pfizer trial, very excited to see its positive results so far. Walter, it sounds like you were pretty familiar with the science behind mRNA vaccines before you signed up to be part of the trial. What initially captured your interest?
I was writing about the biotech revolution, Jennifer Doudna, Emmanuel Charpentier, the people who used CRISPR, which is a ancient method bacteria have for fighting off viruses. They found a way to use it to edit our own genes. That's what won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry this year, the two of them. And so I was very interested in it. I've always been interested in science. But I also feel that we do things in life, like do jury duty, or we do, you know, vote, or we participate in civic life. I think that it's kind of, it helps connect you to science if you participate in civic life by doing a clinical trial for science. And so I think we should all volunteer for these clinical trials. Sometimes we get a little intimidated by our science. We get a little afraid of it or abstracted from it or alienated from it. And this is just a way for us to connect to biology by saying, I'm going to go online to a local hospital and figure out what clinical trials they're doing.
Jennifer on Facebook asks, is this a live vaccine?
So no, it's not a live vaccine. And that is one of the advantages to this. You are not going to be exposed to any actual virus at all, whether it's SARS coronavirus 2 or a different virus, as some of the other vaccines are based on. Messenger RNA is really just a molecule that, again, gives your cells the instructions on how they can make the spike protein. Your cells will then produce that protein and your immune system will respond to it. So there's no live virus or even inactivated virus as any part of this vaccine.
Well, Amber on Facebook asks, how is an mRNA vaccine different from the kind we're used to? What are some already in use and what has the success rate been for those? Are there mRNA vaccines already being used?
So no, these would be the first mRNA vaccines that would be actually on the market available to the public. These mRNA vaccines have gone through phase one trials for other viruses, but they've never gotten an approval. And so they are very different from the current vaccines that are out on the market. Those are all several different types of vaccines. We have inactivated vaccines, which are similar to the flu shot, which are live viruses that have been chemically inactivated, so you're essentially getting exposed to dead virus. We have live attenuated vaccines. A good example of this is the measles vaccine. That's where you get a live virus, but one that is incapable of causing disease. So you develop immunity to the infection, but you don't actually ever get sick from it. And then there's also what are called subunit vaccines. These are proteins, so rather than having your cells make the spike protein, this would be giving your cells the protein after it's been made in a lab. And recently, we have approval for one viral vectored vaccine, which is where you use another virus and then you decorate that or genetically engineer it to express the protein that you are trying to develop immunity to.
Well, there's an ongoing conversation about how fast these vaccines are being developed. And one of you shared this concern with us.
Hi, this is Mitch in Fort Smith, Arkansas. There's a reason that our drug approval process takes a decade. We want to be sure the drugs we are passing out to people are as safe as they can be. mRNA has an endless number of possibilities for damage it can do to your body in terms of silencing genes you're already using. This is just a bad situation, and someone is going to end up taking the blame for forcing through this process when all we really needed to do was distance ourselves, mask up, and let it pass while we studied it.
Walter, as someone participating in the study, how would you respond to that concern?
I think there's always concerns when you try a new vaccine, but this one has had enormous safety testing. There are 44,000 people in the Pfizer trial, and then, of course, the Moderna trial has about another 30,000. There have been no incidents of people being harmed. So I think, he does talk about gene suppression, gene silencing, but there's just no evidence for that. I think if you say you want to wait 10 years to do a vaccine for coronavirus, the coronavirus that causes COVID, I just don't think that trade-off makes any sense to me.
Well, these vaccines are projected to be finished by the end of the year. Angela, how have Pfizer and Moderna been able to develop this vaccine so quickly?
Well, a big advantage to these vaccines, as well as the other vaccines that are in late stage clinical trials, is that you don't actually need to isolate the virus to develop them. You only need the sequence of the viral genome. And that sequence was uploaded on a public server so that the whole world could basically get access to it on January 10th. So when that happened, that allowed us to determine that this virus was in fact a coronavirus. We do have experience developing vaccines, even though they've never come to the market for SARS coronavirus and MERS coronavirus. So we know that the spike protein is what your immune system will be predominantly responding to. So these vaccines were able to take that information about the virus sequence, identify the spike protein, and begin manufacturing these vaccines and designing them essentially the day that the sequence was made available to the public.
We're learning more about mRNA with Angela Rasmussen, a virologist at the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. Also with us, Walter Isaacson. He's participating in the Pfizer vaccine trials. He's a professor of history at Tulane University, whose upcoming book is about the biotech revolution. I'm Jen White. This is 1A from WAMU and NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Headspace. Life can be stressful, but 2020 has challenged even the most difficult times of life. You need stress relief that goes beyond quick fixes. That's Headspace. Headspace is your daily dose of mindfulness in the form of guided meditations and an easy-to-use app. Need help falling asleep? Headspace has wind-down sessions. Go to headspace.com/1A for a free month trial with access to Headspace's full library of meditations for every situation.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or maybe perfect strangers? You can get all the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle on the 1A News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday.
Since the 1980s, hip-hop and America's prisons have grown side by side.
And we're going to investigate this connection to see how it lifts us up and holds us down.
Hip-hop is talking about what we live, trying to live the American dream, failing at the American dream.
I'm Sydney Madden.
I'm Rodney Carmichael. Listen now to the Louder Than a Riot podcast from NPR Music,
where we trace the collision of rhyme and punishment in America.
I'm Jen White. This is 1A. We're discussing the new mRNA vaccines with Walter Isaacson. He's a professor of history at Tulane University and author of the upcoming book, The Codebreaker. It explores gene editing and the biotech revolution. He's also a participant in the Pfizer vaccine trials. Also with us, Angela Rasmussen, a virologist with the Columbia University Mailman School of Public Health. Here's another concern one of you shared with us.
Hi, I'm Eliza from Garden City, Michigan. I'm wondering about the long-term side effects. I can't find anything online that refutes or supports any chance of long-term side effects that isn't absolutely unscientific. What sort of things are we missing by the emergency order, and how can I refute those fears to people who want to wait until some unforeseen thing happens to get the vaccine?
Okay, so Angela, let's start. She refers to an emergency order there, but I think she means the emergency use from the FDA. How would you respond to Eliza? Is there anything in the data from the Pfizer and Moderna trials that might help ease her concerns?
So yes and no. Trials like this on this time scale obviously can't look at those long-term potential side effects any more than they can look at durability or how long the vaccine's protection lasts. And that durability question is something that's normally addressed in phase three trials the way that they have been done previously, where, as a previous caller pointed out, they can take years. But the thing is, long-term side effects for most vaccines are actually quite rare, and they're often not observed even in those longer durability trials that I mentioned. So often, those types of side effects really only become apparent once a vaccine is actually released onto the market and people begin to be immunized by the millions. And really, we're talking about the rate of side effects that are like 1 in a million, 1 in 500,000 in terms of side effects. So those wouldn't be normally detected in any clinical trial, regardless of the time scale that it's on. So I think that in terms of people waiting for a vaccine, people are really going to have no choice but to wait unless they're a frontline healthcare worker, just because of when these vaccines will actually become available to the general public. So people really shouldn't worry too much, I think, about long-term side effects, because these trials do look at the short-term safety profiles. And so we should have good information about that. People should just remind themselves that these long-term side effects are usually extremely rare and unlikely to be any less rare for these vaccines than for any other vaccine.
Walter, were side effects a concern for you when you signed up to be a part of the trial?
No, I mean, you have side effects from, you know, anything from not only flu shots, but taking a long hot shower. But there's no there's no evidence that there'd be any serious side effects whatsoever. And with all the people who have done the trial since August 1st, there was no side effect. Now, the real question, as Angela just said, is, what about 5-10 years from now, or 4-5 years from now? Angela, I think, gave a good answer for that. I mean, nothing in life is certain, but this is certainly a good health vaccine.
Well, Adam on Facebook says, one could reasonably presume that those participating in the trial are more likely to wear masks and socially distance than the wider population, and they're more likely to follow through with the second shot. Walter, I'm not sure the Pfizer trial includes two shots, but to Adam's point, were you given any specific guidance on your behavior as part of this trial?
No, we were just told to behave as we normally would. I got a booster shot or a booster placebo after 3 weeks. So it does take two shots, as does the Moderna vaccine. And yeah, it's possible that people who do vaccine clinical trials are a little bit safer than people who don't. One of the things that's interesting, hadn't gotten much play, is they held up the Moderna trial, clinical trial, which could have finished sometime around October. And one reason was there was a request that they add more diversity, which is not exactly the question that was asked. But if you get all the same type of people who volunteer, you don't get racial, ethnic, socioeconomic, economic diversity. And they required Moderna to add more diversity. Pfizer had done that by going from 30,000 up to 44,000. And going back to a point Angela just made about future vaccines, one of the cool things about RNA is that when you have a vaccine like that, you can reprogram it for to make any protein or take on any new virus that comes along. And reprogramming it, you know, could take just a couple of days. Even a graduate student in biology, once you get the genetic sequence of a new virus that comes along, you can reprogram a messenger RNA virus. It won't be quite that simple, but it won't be like trying to create from scratch a new vaccine.
Walter, how does it feel to be a part of this moment in history? As someone who's looking at the future of biotechnology, where do you see that future heading?
You know, I think we've had three great technology revolutions of our time. You know, we've had the atomic revolution beginning of the 20th century. And that leads to everything from atom bombs to GPS to microchips and transistors and semiconductors. Then we had an information technology revolution that begins in the 60s with the invention of the computer, the microchip, and the internet. And most of our kids, we sort of push them to learn how to code, because if you're going to be part of the information technology revolution, you had to know digital coding. I think beginning in 2000 with the sequencing of the human genome by the Human Genome Project, and now all the way through, you know, 2012 with the invention of ways to use RNA to edit human genes, like with CRISPR, we're at the beginning of a great 50-year period that will be a biotech revolution. And I think our kids who know how to code will also have to know the code of life. They'll have to understand genetic coding. And it's interesting the way a new revolution can come on like this. Well, COVID will help spur it even faster, because between CRISPR gene editing and then having to fight viruses, molecules will be the new microchip.
That's Walter Isaacson. He's a participant in the Pfizer vaccine trials, and he's written plenty of excellent books. His latest one will be out next year. It's called The Codebreaker. It explores gene editing and the biotech revolution. Walter, we really appreciate your time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Also with us, Angela Rasmussen. Now, Angela, you got a new job since we last talked. You're now an affiliate with Georgetown Center for Global Health Science Security. And we have lots more questions for you from people who want to better understand vaccines and vaccine development. And here's a question about who the vaccine is for.
Hi, my name is Rachel, and I'm calling from Aberdeen, North Carolina. I am wondering if you guys can discuss how exactly this vaccine is going to work if we can't vaccinate children. I was listening to NPR yesterday, and they were talking about how the AAP is suggesting developing a vaccine for kids and testing on kids and so on. And it was just an absolute shock to me, because I've never heard a mention of the vaccine not being for kids. And it just really has me wondering how it works if we can't vaccinate our children too and protect them too.
Rachel, thanks. Angela, what is the protocol here? Are any of the vaccines currently in development being tested on children?
As far as I know, they are not. And that's actually an excellent point that Rachel brings up. So these trials enrolled adults, including, and there was a real strong desire to enroll adults who would be in various high-risk categories. So people who are HIV positive or immunosuppressed, people with diabetes or heart conditions, pre-existing conditions that we know increase risk for severe COVID, as well as older people and people from diverse racial and ethnic backgrounds. Now, that said, there were several groups of people, including children, that were left out of this. And I think that's something that does need to be addressed very quickly. So children and pregnant women in particular have not been evaluated in these trials. And that's something that all of these vaccine manufacturers are going to have to start testing and addressing as soon as possible. Because even though children are at lower risk of developing severe COVID, they can certainly get infected. They can have very negative severe disease outcomes, although they are more rare, they do occur. And they can also transmit the virus to other people in their household. So it is really important that we start addressing some of these populations of people who were excluded from these initial clinical trials.
Rebecca on Facebook wants to know, A, what the current thought is on how long the vaccine will be effective, and when should I be able to get it?
So we don't know. The short answer about how long the vaccine will be effective is that we don't know. Likely, it probably will be at least a year, because that's what most vaccines do provide, that sort of protection. It could be longer, but unfortunately, the only way to assess durability is to really vaccinate people and then wait and see when their antibody titers start to decrease or see when they might start becoming more susceptible. So I think though we can conservatively estimate that at least a year in terms of the length of protection. I think that in terms of when the vaccine will be available, when people should get it, assuming that the FDA approves the safety and efficacy data, I would get it as soon as possible. Realistically, because I'm not a frontline healthcare worker, I'm not an older person, that means that I probably won't get access to it until at the earliest next spring, but more likely potentially even next summer. So I think that, you know, we still need to be wearing our masks and practicing distancing and taking all these other precautions for some time to come.
Briefly, Angela, Aaron on Twitter wants to know, what made COVID-19 a good candidate for an mRNA vaccine?
So really, COVID was a good candidate because we had the sequence early on, and it was clear, even though it may not have been clear in early January, it was clear that this was an emerging virus that could present a significant public health risk to the world. And the mRNA vaccine platform is really well suited to rapidly designing and developing a vaccine. So I think that really it was more an expeditious need for a vaccine, getting one as soon as possible to deal with this public health crisis, that made mRNA vaccines a good platform for this purpose.
We're discussing potential mRNA vaccine candidates with Angela Rasmussen. She's an affiliate with Georgetown Center for Global Health Science Security. I'm Jen White. We'll hear more from you and from our guest in a moment.
Frogs pooping beetles, featherless flying reptiles, stinky chatty cheese. We got it all on Wow in the World, the NPR podcast for kids. I'm Mindy Thomas, inviting you to join me and Guy Raz for an animated scientific adventure of the mind. It's Wow in the World from Tinkercast and NPR. Listen now.
Now let's get back to talking about the mRNA COVID vaccines that are in development with Angela Rasmussen. She's an affiliate with Georgetown Center for Global Health Science Security. Kathy asks, can you explain the difference between the three vaccines in case there's a choice between them? So we have the Pfizer vaccine, the Moderna vaccine, and then the one from AstraZeneca.
Yeah, absolutely. So the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are very similar in that they're both mRNA vaccines that are essentially delivering these instructions to your cells on how to make the spike protein that they're immunizing you against. The AstraZeneca vaccine is very different. It actually is what's called a viral vectored vaccine, and it actually uses a different virus to essentially deliver the gene for the spike protein to your cells. So it is a different type of virus called a chimpanzee adenovirus. It's a type of virus that normally causes common cold-like symptoms in chimpanzees, but it can also infect humans. It doesn't go through a full replication cycle, but it will infect your cells, and then it will express the spike protein because it's been genetically engineered to do so. So they're very, very different vaccine strategies. They have their benefits and drawbacks. There are some concerns about the AstraZeneca vaccine in the sense that it is also a two-shot regimen, but it looks like people may actually be developing immunity to the vaccine itself when it's being given in that first shot, which may mean that it's not able to properly boost in the second shot. So right now, if I had my choice, I would probably choose to take the Moderna or Pfizer vaccines just because it seems like they may be more effective.
Yeah, we'll get more into the details of that AstraZeneca vaccine in a bit. But first, Terry on Twitter says, I'm concerned I'm not hearing a lot about the side effects of the new vaccines. What can your guests say about that, if anything?
Well, so we haven't seen the full safety data from either of the Pfizer or Moderna phase 3 trials. But in the phase 1 and phase 1-2 trials, there were some side effects reported. They're mostly typical vaccine side effects, such as fever, in some cases nausea, muscle soreness at the site of injection. There were a couple of what are called severe adverse events, which are events that are more severe, but nothing that would preclude us from saying, okay, this vaccine is dangerous. It can actually cause significant long-term harm to people. So while we do need to wait and actually look at the safety data from these phase 3 trials when they are presented to the FDA, and hopefully the companies will share them as well themselves, there's really no indication that these vaccines are very different from the side effects that we normally expect from other types of vaccines.
Well, Andrea on Twitter says, can you address safety for people with various autoimmune diseases such as MS, rheumatoid arthritis, et cetera?
So, unfortunately not, again, because I haven't seen the actual granular safety data. But for people with autoimmune diseases or inflammatory conditions, whether they should get any vaccine is something that they need to discuss with their provider. Because many of these conditions are actually very different, and some people are medically contraindicated to take vaccines because of the potential for adverse effects that would be caused by whatever immune or inflammatory condition they have. So that really is something that patients should be deciding with their providers and their physicians.
Well, I want to turn our attention to AstraZeneca, which has become the third company with a seemingly effective vaccine candidate. The company said its early analysis was based on 131 coronavirus cases. The trial used two different dosing regimens, one of which was 90% effective in preventing COVID-19, and the other was 62% effective. Joining us now is David Miliband. He's the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. That's a global humanitarian aid, relief, and development organization. David, welcome.
Thanks very much. It's great to be with you.
So AstraZeneca says that they have created what they're calling a vaccine for the world. What does that mean?
They've pledged AstraZeneca to make 2 billion doses of the vaccine available in 92 of the poorest countries in the world. And they've pledged to do it at $3 a dose. So that's obviously much cheaper than the average of $20 a dose that's been used for some of the other vaccines. Obviously, I'm not here to represent AstraZeneca. I'm concerned about populations around the world who don't have the benefit of effective health systems that can guarantee the kind of effective delivery, including sustaining the right temperatures for the vaccine to ensure that it's delivered. And we serve at the International Rescue Committee war-torn populations in places like Syria or Yemen, displaced populations in places like Ethiopia, and of course, refugees in places like Jordan and Lebanon or Uganda.
So what would a vaccine like this mean for the work you're doing at the IRC?
Well, obviously, the key is to get life back to some kind of normality. Now, the health impact of COVID has been less than we expected. It's been bad, but it's not been the rampant killer. But nonetheless, there's real need to get health services back on their feet so that non-COVID cases, as well as COVID itself, can be treated properly. But the economic collateral damage of COVID has been huge, the lockdowns, the interruption of supply chains. And so the vaccine does need to be a vaccine for the world, not just a vaccine for the rich world. And that's true on moral grounds, but also because we all know that until this disease is vanquished all over the world, it's going to remain a threat, even in those countries that manage to get high levels of vaccination.
And Angela, explain a little bit more about these two different dosing regimens AstraZeneca is using.
Yeah, that's an excellent question and one that I've had myself. So it turns out that one of the dosing regimens was actually because of a mistake in which the people conducting the trial miscalculated the first dose for trial participants and gave them half the dose. As it turned out, that ended up being more effective, probably because, as I mentioned earlier, this is a viral vectored vaccine, so you do have the potential to produce immune responses to any exposure to the vaccine itself. The half dose followed by a full dose was actually, according to their data, 90% effective compared to the two full dose regimen, which was only about 62% efficacious. So that's a huge difference. And it does seem as though the half dose regimen may be the way to go. But that, of course, has to be evaluated in a larger trial. And this is one of the main questions that I've had, and I think many of my colleagues have had, is that if this was a mistake, and the phase three trial that's currently going on is using the two full dose regimen, will they be able to enroll additional participants to look at this half dose regimen, or what are their plans for that? I think that's really crucial to since there was such a large observed difference in efficacy. Also, because as David correctly said, you know, this can't be a vaccine for only the wealthy countries. This has to be a vaccine for everyone. So you want to make sure that if you are rolling that out to the global population, that you are using the most efficacious formulation.
David, what are the biggest barriers for distributing a vaccine around the globe? You mentioned storage, but what are some of the other things at play?
Well, first and most obviously, in countries that are in conflict, it's very hard to get safe passage. We're obviously all very concerned about the situation in Ethiopia, 110 million people, second largest country in Africa, lots of political tension there. So one, conflict is no respecter of vaccination campaigns, and that's a real danger. Secondly, we know that in many of the most fragile parts of the world, which we serve, it's probably 3 hours to get to a health center. So we worry about situations where the local health infrastructure is weak, and we need to change our philosophy, or the philosophy of the health system. Instead of expecting people to get to healthcare, our philosophy is we've got to take healthcare to people. And that's the use of what are called community health workers. And that raises a third point. If you're moving beyond the infrastructure of a health system with proper electricity, refrigeration, etc., you need to make sure that you're able to get the doses to people in a form where they still work. Now, obviously, the Pfizer issue of the negative 70 degrees is very worrying indeed. We've seen estimates from the UN that 30% of the global population won't be helped if the supply chain requires 35 to 46 degrees of temperature. So you can see that the third big danger is that we can't get the right kind of infrastructure to people in need, especially those who've been displaced by conflict and are not living in urban centers.
David, very, very briefly, what are your big picture thoughts about the importance of making sure an effective vaccine, once available, is distributed globally?
Well, if we don't distribute it globally, then we're not going to have safety locally. We know that even the 95% rates that exist for some of the vaccines mean that some people will still be vulnerable. And we need to vanquish this disease on a global scale as a matter of self-interest, not just a matter of morality. It really counts. We need U.S. leadership because the world is weaker without it.
That's David Miliband. He's the president and CEO of the International Rescue Committee. Also with us, Angela Rasmussen, a virologist. Rather, she's an affiliate at the Georgetown Center for Global Health Science and Security. Thanks to you both for your time. Today's producer was Emmanuel Johnson. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. From all of us on 1A, happy Thanksgiving, and thanks for listening.